Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Not everyone in prison is there for the right reason. The documentary True Conviction looks at three men who were wrongly convicted, eventually exonerated, and released after years of incarceration. The film follows their quest to help other innocent men behind bars. You can see it Monday, April 30th. That's tonight, 9 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Mountain, Independent Lens on SDPB TV. Today, joining me on the program, director Jamie Meltzer. His feature documentary films have been broadcast on PBS and have screened at film festivals worldwide. Jamie Meltzer, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
These men have a quite fascinating and really tragic or heartbreaking in some ways stories, and they're part of this growing fraternity of innocent men who are trying to figure out what to do with their lives after being wrongfully imprisoned. Tell me about the main characters, the men that you follow for this documentary.
Well, in 2012, a friend of mine invited me to sit in on a kind of group therapy session of a group of maybe 12, 15 men in Dallas who had all been wrongfully convicted and exonerated, found innocent and released. And I went there and met the main subject. His name's Christopher Scott. He did 13 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. Johnny Lindsay, who had done 26 years for a sexual assault that he didn't commit. And Stephen Phillips, who'd done 25 years for a series of sexual assaults that he did not commit. And I was just really moved when they were sharing their stories with one another and the sort of brotherhood that they had between them, as well as their mission to turn this tragic experience that they'd all had into something positive and meaningful. I just thought that was just something that I almost couldn't imagine myself doing. You'd like to think that you'd come out of this experience and want to, you know, be a force for good, but you also think you might be very bitter and angry. And, you know, they have a small part of this anger that drives them, but really they're driven by this sort of mission to make change and to investigate cases of people that are in prison now that claim to be innocent.
And they could do anything. They could leave the whole, process, the whole, these painful stories, this justice system, which did not do right by them. They could leave it all behind. What do you think really motivates them? Is it partially this connection that they have with each other?
Yeah, I think it's really to make meaning, I think, of what happened to them, because I think it becomes a very difficult and dark place if you've experienced this and, can't sort of make sense of it, you know. And I think that giving back and trying to do something positive just kind of gives a purpose to what happened to them in a way. They support one another as a group, too. There's this larger group that I kind of plugged into of maybe 30, 35 exonerees in Dallas County. And then the smaller group that's the center of my film, which is just these three guys who really love and support and challenge one another to kind of be their best selves. I think what motivates them, too, is, you know, when I would film them, and I filmed them investigating several cases, when we would film them, you know, taking on a case, deciding which case to take on, they would always talk about their own case. So they would try to see something. If they saw something in a case that they were looking at and reading the files on, and they said, hey, that sounds like, you know, what happened to me, you know, that kind of attitude by the prosecutor or the police officer or something that a witness said. And so they felt like they had this experience and had been, and that kind of gave them the wisdom, the knowledge to apply what happened to them to help other people, and the alarm bells kind of go off for them when they're reading these cases and they see the same things that happened to them these many years ago, you know, before they were, when they were convicted.
We see throughout the film so many different ways where you illustrate what's at stake, and it's more than being able to walk outside and breathe free air and the implications for the other people in their lives. At one point, I think it's Christopher Scott's mother who is talking and saying, you know, she wanted everyone to know that this wasn't her son. Her son wasn't a murderer. Later on in the film, there's a talk about the victims really having the right to know that the wrong person was brought to justice and that the criminal might still be, you know, somewhere else. What else did you sort of see that was really just, you know, at stake for these people that
yeah.
You know, made you think twice about the whole process.
Yeah, I went into making the film as a kind of an innocent, really, someone not knowing a lot about wrongful convictions and the criminal justice system. And I was really kind of horrified by what I saw. And I think two things that the film shows and that I experienced in making it is that wrongful convictions not only destroy and, you know, impair the life of the person who's wrongfully convicted. I mean, that's an outrage in and of itself and could lead to someone being, you know, executed in some cases. But not only that, but it really destroys everyone around them. Yeah. And we really see that in the film, the way it affects Chris's mother, the way it affects all of their families. You know, they lost all this time with their children. Some of their children end up, as in the film, you see, you know, being sort of having challenging lives of their own because right. they just didn't have a father figure. So there's that, you know, this. And then the other thing is that I hadn't thought about before, and I don't think most people think about with wrongful convictions, is it's not just about the person who was wrongfully convicted, and like I said, their family, but it's also about the fact that there's someone out there who committed this crime. And so right. in the case of Stephen Phillips, who was convicted for a string of sexual assaults, the person who actually committed those crimes was just left to go free. And they committed many more across the whole country. And, you know, Stephen talks about that in the film. He says, you know, that should be a crime in and of itself. We should right. hold these prosecutors accountable for withholding evidence. And then there's more crimes that result.
What are the men finding? What did you see? You know, how did this happen? Are they find certain patterns that they recognize? How do so many of these wrongful convictions occur?
Well, first you have to kind of acknowledge the racial bias in the system and the fact that these wrongful convictions happen disproportionately to African-American men. And then the main reasons that we found in the film, and we chose, you know, these two cases that they look into in the film. One's of a man on death row in Texas. He's the longest serving prisoner on death row at the time that we filmed with him. And he had a false confession. So he initially confessed to committing a crime under certain circumstances that are complicated, but that the film goes into. And that people think that that never happens. It actually happens quite often that people falsely confess. Something like 25 to 30% of the wrongful convictions and exonerations are associated with false confessions. So it's very possible and happens all the time. And if there's no corroborating physical evidence, you know, it should not be taken as you know, a sacred thing by a jury. And then the other main reason is witness misidentification. That's that's an even bigger reason, especially when witnesses try to identify someone across racial lines. And so that's also a contributing factor to how a lot of African American men, I think, are wrongfully convicted. Witness misidentifications. I think most people think, oh, it's a witness, you know, saying that this person did it, you know, and there's, you know, that's, you know, kind of a bulletproof piece of evidence, and it's really not. And again, if it doesn't come with physical evidence to back it up, it really is not sufficient.
In Christopher Scott's case, that's a stark reminder, because he even says at the point, you know, he's brought into the courtroom and the judge is white, the jury is all white, the prosecutor's white, and he just knows at that moment, even though he's innocent, that he's not going to get out of this. So he has an intuitive sense of the racial bias that he's facing based on what he sees around him.
Yeah, and this is someone who... he had committed no crimes before in his life. He was a young man in his late 20s. And, you know, I think they just had a certain set of assumptions about him. And there was a witness that identified him, even though he looked nothing like the actual perpetrator. What happened was the police officers brought this woman who was distraught over the killing of her husband into the police station. And Chris was sitting there on a bench. And the police officer says, right, he's the only one there sitting on this bench, and the police officer points to him and says, is this the man? And there's no one else, so it's not a proper lineup. You know, it's very suggestive, and she ended up choosing him. And so that's, you know, one way that these sort of witness misidentifications can happen.
as these men go and talk to, they talk to jurors, they talk to prosecutors, law enforcement officers, they kind of conduct their own investigation, looking into the cases. How do people respond to some of these questions? There's some contentious conversations.
And it's interesting with this set of guys, because these are all guys who are wrongfully convicted, but they don't have any investigative experience. You know, they're not trained investigators, they're not lawyers. But it actually turns out that, in a way, it's a strength. They have the strength of their stories. The fact that they've been through a wrongful conviction themselves means that almost nobody's going to turn them away from, you know, talking to them. So they can really talk to any of the witnesses, the prosecutors, the and anyone that they need to talk to in a case. And they kind of open those people up, because people just tend to open up around them because their stories are so compelling and they're really charismatic, you know, individuals. So that really helps them. But there is one scene in the film where, it's sort of, it gets a little bit out of control in terms of the emotions. And that was a scene where the three guys who had all been wrongfully convicted were interviewing a prosecutor on one of the cases. And the prosecutor invokes the reason of why he knew that this person he was prosecuting was guilty was because God told him so. And he, and that was the evidence that he essentially gives. And, you know, that really just set them off, because the guys are always talking about the tunnel vision that prosecutors have when they think that they have their man, quote unquote. They, can lose sight of the fact that there might be things that don't corroborate that. And it's obviously such an outrageous thing for someone to kind of reference, religion in the context of, justice and the law. So that sort of turned into a very contentious that turned into a difficult conversation.
There is such a big responsibility, and you really capture this in Christopher Scott's face often, all the men, but he's visiting with some of these people behind bars, and you can see the pain that it causes him. He's an empathetic man, and he hears their suffering, and he wants to help. He's afraid of giving them hope, but he's tenacious in keeping going. What kind of burden or sort of ongoing struggle is it for the men to sort of hear these stories, carry the stories, and face a really complex system that is not easy to exonerate someone?
Yeah, it's near impossible. I mean, it's a near impossibility to get someone exonerated, especially if there's no DNA evidence to test. And that's the kind of cases that Chris and his team take on. And that's because Chris didn't have DNA evidence in his case. And he likes to say he was one in a million. That was his chances of getting out with no DNA. And that's also true of all the cases that they take on. They have the same odds. So I think it haunts them, what they went through. And, and I think it does affect them to meet with these people in prison. But I think they're an important group of investigators, because you or I are probably going to be more skeptical of someone's story. If they're proclaiming their innocence, we're probably going to say, or an investigator or a lawyer is going to say, yeah, everybody says they're innocent in prison. But Chris and his team are going to listen, because they weren't listened to. And they're going to hear that out. Then they're going to test it against the evidence. And they're going to, they're going to give them the benefit of the doubt until it's proven otherwise. And I think that's a really important kind of way that they have of looking at this, at the justice system. That's, obviously influenced by their experiences.
At one point, one of them says, I don't like this guy. And the other says, well, it's really not about whether we like him or not. It's about the facts of the case. So they struggle with the same things that many of us would struggle with as we look at some of these, the situations, and face some pretty grisly crimes, too.
Yeah. And in that case, it does come up that, one of the people that they end up advocating for isn't the most sympathetic person. We'd like the people that were wrongfully convicted to be, have no blemishes and no problems in their past. And, sometimes that can lead to a wrongful conviction, sort of just having a past that makes it easy for the prosecutor to kind of put something else on you. Again, they're much more willing to forgive and move past that because of how they've been colored by their own experience and how people see them and have seen them, you know. And yeah, go ahead.
There's one scene in here that I think is really important. I don't want to give too much away about the details of the film because people definitely want to tune in and see it unfold. But there's a scene where one of the men is sort of in a crisis of his own, and there's a conversation between the three men, and they talk about shame, and they talk about, you know, this isn't just about you, this is about us. And it is really one of the most honest, friendly, confrontational, but take no guff kind of conversations between three men that I've seen on film in a long time. What was that moment like for you, sort of watching that unfold and watching how they supported each other, but really did not make any excuses for each other?
Yeah, well, one of the exonerees in the film struggles with, addiction issues. And really, as we kind of get into in the film, you know, a lot of that is a result of just sort of PTSD and sort of after being in prison for 26 years for something you didn't do, you know, trying to get on this path afterwards is not easy emotionally. And they all struggle with that. But I think this was something that we saw when we were filming, and we realized this really kind of does shed light on the struggles that they're all going through. They're not all going through sort of problems specific with alcohol and drugs, but they're all going through emotional struggles that we might not see on the outside, because one of the things about these three guys is they dress incredibly well. You know, they look like real detectives, and, you know, in terms of how they kind of dress, and, you know, sort of the classic detective, you know, beautiful tailored suits, et cetera. But underneath that, there is a lot of pain, you know, and I think they understand one another's pain. And I think you see that in the scene that you're talking about, where one of them sort of falls down, the other one go to try to pick him up. But they also apply some, I guess what you call tough love towards him, you know, because they've been through it before with him, and they were frustrated too. Yeah, I think that's the kind of scene that, you know, a documentary can give you above a fiction film. You know, something that's really surprising that happens within the context of what you're filming, and something really raw and authentic in that way, too.
Jamie Meltzer, the film is called True Conviction. Listeners can see it tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB TV. Jamie, it's a great film. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.